Hello, this is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime, 9 o'clock horses. Episode 28. This is the final episode. Now that my brother had gone, I wasn't sure why I needed to go to England. It's wonderful to have a destination, a place not visited before. But now, what was the point? Jenny suggested that I go to Foxby. Could I really go back there after 30 years? But I wasn't going to miss the chance to travel or waste a ticket so graciously given to me. It was slow going through British customs. Now I had to take a tube to St. Pancras Station, where I could catch the train to Leicester. At the tube station entrance, the "You Are Here" lettering was almost worn away with constant fingering. I tried to focus on the labyrinth of train lines in different colours when a man's voice piped up behind me. "Where you want to go, lady?" "Oh," I said, "I'm trying to get St. Pancras." I turned to see a tall, white-haired man in a raincoat. He ran his finger along the map. "There to there, then change to the blue line at Leicester Square to St. Pancras." It looked complicated, but before I could answer, he had disappeared, swept away among the crowds. Steep elevators coming up and going down were packed with businessmen and smartly dressed women who swooshed past me, efficient in a long-practiced jog-trot, briskly clip-clipping to the bottom of the moving stairs. I stayed on the right side of the escalator, my suitcase balanced precariously one step below as the stairs slid noisily down into the cavernous depth of the white-tiled tunnel. I could see why a lot of people had sheltered down the tube stations to escape the Blitz during World War II. A strong gush of air blasted out of the tunnel as the train arrived. Engines throbbed loudly and the doors rumbled open. I was carried inside by a surge of people and barely able to keep my balance as the engines were revived. The doors closed quickly. Immediately, they opened again, and a man shouted over the intercom, "Please do not obstruct the doors, thank you." Once again, the doors clanged shut, and with a long sigh from the brakes, we were off, hurtling through blackness for a moment before slowing to a halt at the next brightly lit station. I was the only one on the bus to Foxby. The road wound silver through the countryside. Beech trees with fans of pale green leaves lined the fields beside the road. Elms waiting to burst into bud stood dark and stately along the banks of streams, still running swiftly from late winter rains. When I think about the population of England and the amount of countryside still green and beautiful, it amazes me. England comprises 94,000 square miles and fits easily into the state of Oregon, which has a population of 3.5 million, compared to 65 million people in England in the smaller space. And yet, small villages stand isolated among the 1,500 miles of Greenbelt. No one is allowed to build on the Greenbelts around the burgeoning cities of Britain. The bus sped along Main Street and lurched to a stop in front of the Bull's Head Inn. "Last stop," the driver said. I stepped off the bus onto a wet pavement. Brakes hissed and the doors rumbled shut behind me. I stood for a moment to watch the bus turn around by the old school, a low, brick, U-shaped building with iron railings around the playground. I remember when Colin and I had run sticks along the railings. Now, above the entrance, a sign read, "Bingo, every Saturday night." Well, things had changed. The bus disappeared, leaving a trace of diesel hanging in the damp air. It reminded me of Manhattan and the daily bus trips to and from work at the stock market before I left New York for Redondo Beach with Joseph. Shops still lined Foxby High Street. The names on the doors had changed. The large car park had replaced the house next door to the inn. Inside, I was greeted by a tall young man standing behind a dark wooden counter. "On holiday, are we, then?" His broad Midlands dialect sounded odd to me. "Sort of," I smiled. "It's been a while." "Did you live here?" "Once I did. I left for America when I was 22. I smiled. "Long time ago." The young man showed me to a room which he described as the biggest one at the inn. I sat on the side of the double bed, finding the mattress comfortably firm. I decided a rest might do the trick before I began to explore the village. The tall young man brought me tea, as I'd asked. "Everything all right, then, miss?" "Fine, fine, thank you." I stood by the window, sipping the tea. I watched a young girl pushing a stroller along the road toward the post office. Her hair was a mixture of henna, bleached blonde and purple. Her faded jeans were halfway down her backside, revealing an inch or two of white skin. When I lived in Foxby, I remembered girls around her age wore dresses or skirts and pretty blouses or sweaters. Venturing outside into the cool of the early afternoon, I stood at the corner of Gregory Lane. St. Giles Church, with its Saxon tower, still loomed over crumbling gravestones. But the cottages along the lane were gone, replaced with elegant two-story homes on a wide paved road. There were no hens clucking around pretty gardens, no cows plodding up the muddy lane to Hadley's farm. I wondered if the field still lay beyond the lane. Perhaps, I thought with a shudder, there's just a long road of new, look-alike brick houses with cars parked outside. Relieved, when I turned the corner, I spied the gate. I remembered the old wooden one that had a rubber tire nailed to it, so it didn't disturb the residents at the top of the lane. Now the gate clanged shut behind me. I looked toward the bridge over the canal. The wind sighed, and scudding clouds cast shadows light, dark, light, over the tall waving grass, just like it used to be. Colin and I used to walk to the lockhouse by the side of the canal, 2 miles further along. We used to perch on the edge of one of the arms of the lock to eat his mother's homemade cake. Everything tasted much better outside. Colin had talked non-stop about our future in America. He had picked me up and twirled me around. "America, here we come." If only it had been that simple. My attention was drawn to the drone of a tractor in the field next to the farm. I wondered who owned it now. Who would be on the tractor preparing the wet ground for a summer crop of wheat? I could just see the field next to the farm where the scented cowslips grew. I felt the sudden urge to find some, maybe pick a bunch. I was glad I had worn sensible lace-up shoes as I trudged through the wet grass. The tractor was close by now. I shielded my eyes to see the man as he perched high on the seat of the tractor in the next field. I couldn't see him clearly, but I heard his voice. "Hello," he shouted. "Finding what you want?" "Is it all right if I pick some cowslips?" "Go right ahead, my dear. Just visiting then, are ya?" "Yes, it's been a long time since I was in Foxby. I love these flowers. Can't remember seeing any in the States."
"The States, eh?"
I heard him shut off the engine, and then he was through the gate and plodding toward me. He said,
"I keep cows in this field. Just watch your step, eh?"
I laughed. I will. I picked a long stem and held it up to my nose. "Lovely," I said, studying the bloom of pale yellow cups on the long stem. The man was staring at me. He removed his hat. He was unshaven. His hair looked very white against his brown, weather-beaten face. I said, "You know, these flowers always remind me of a Shakespeare poem, something like, where the bee sucks, there suck I, in a cowslip bell I lie. I think that's how it goes. Something like that." He nodded, and a smile crept to his lips. He said, "How about, the cowslips tall her pensioners be, in their gold coats spots I see." "Right," I said, "that's Shakespeare too." The man stood awkwardly, fiddling with his hat.
"You don't recognize me, do you?" he finally said. I looked more closely. "I'm sorry, I don't."
"I know who you are, though," he smiled. I stared up at him. He was familiar in a way.
Suddenly he laughed. "Amelia!"
"Colin?" Suddenly I felt the ground sway beneath my feet. I was looking at the man I still dreamed about, still loved. I tried to speak but couldn't. I thought I was going to faint.
He stepped forward to hold me steady. "Come on," he said. "Let's get you a cup of tea."
I was numb as he led me into the cluttered living room of the farmhouse. It was the same as I remembered it, with newspapers spread untidily on the chair. Although it was spring, the air in the room was chill, and I watched as he knelt to light the fire in the small grate. Then with a nod, he went into the kitchen. I could hear him filling the kettle. I sat staring into the green flames of the coal fire. He returned with biscuits and tea on a tray and set it carefully on the stool by my side. Then he sat opposite, on the worn sofa, watching me. We didn't talk. I couldn't get my brain to cooperate with where I was. He leaned forward.
"You're okay?" he asked. "Still married?"
I looked up. He died.
"Oh, God, I'm so sorry."
"So," I said, "Colin, when did you get out of Vietnam?"
"Well," he hesitated, "I got out in 73. I lived in France for some years, but, you know, I didn't come back here until 84 when I bought this place. That's when I learned you were married."
73, I said. "Why didn't you try to find me?"
"Oh, you wouldn't have wanted to see me then. I was messed up."
"What do you mean, messed up?"
"Listen, can we talk about this later? Let's talk about you, eh?"
But I said, "Who told you about me?"
I was trying to remember where I was in 1973.
I waited for him to answer.
"I went to see your parents. It was just your dad and Douglas. You know, your mum was gone then. Douglas told me you'd married a fella, John, that's all."
"So why didn't you contact me then?" I said. "Douglas didn't tell me you'd been to see them." I watched the clock on the wall, the pendulum swinging back and forth, the minutes ticking by. I finally spoke, my eyes never leaving the clock. "The thing is, Colin, why didn't my father or Douglas tell me you were alive?"
"Oh, I told them not to. Why would I want to interfere with your life? They understood, and what would be the point? Can't you see that?"
I was suddenly weeping. I said,
Because it would have relieved my guilt, that's why."
"Guilt?
Don't you know how much I hated myself for making you go to the States, and then you were in the military, and then Vietnam, and then I heard you were missing, and then you were dead. You were dead, Colin. In my mind, all these years, I've blamed myself for you going to America. Don't you understand? I thought you were dead. I killed you, in a way."
"Hey, hey,"
he reached for my hands and held them still.
"Amelia, when you had TB, I was excited about leaving England. You were not to blame for me going to the States. You get that into your head right now." He held tight to my hands.
"Listen, lass, it's all too long ago. Look at me. I'm okay." But I was over the edge. I was held prisoner for a long time. You have no idea how it was.
"Oh, Colin," I said, "I'm sorry. I still don't understand. You were in communications behind the scenes. How come you were in danger?"
"I'll tell you sometimes, lass, not now." He obviously wanted to change the subject, and he said, "You know, it was only by chance I came back to Foxby. See how the farm was? It was for sale. Had been for a long time. Needed repairs everywhere. I bought it."
"If only I'd known you were alive," I whispered. "It would have made my life happier." Amelia, you've had a decent marriage, a good life, haven't you?
I nodded. Yes, and I have a lovely daughter. She gave me the ticket to come here this time.
I'd love to meet her, you know.
I didn't answer. Outside, the birds were gathering for the night in the elm tree. For a while, their chattering filled the dusk with noise. Then it was quiet, I said. I have to go back to the inn now. Perhaps we can talk tomorrow.
Tell you what, lass, I'll freshen up a bit and walk with you down to the pub. They do a nice cottage pie and we can have a good old chat. How's that?
I nodded. Without talking, we walked arm in arm down the narrow path to the village. Colin would not talk about Vietnam. I asked him a lot of questions, but his answers were vague. He'd asked how my father was and how I finally got to the States. He wanted to know who I'd been married to, all about Jenny. I told him about my travels, the countries I'd visited, how I now lived by the beach on the west coast of America. I did all the talking. He asked me about my mother.
You know your mum, she was always a nervous lady, wasn't she? He said.
Yeah, you're right there, Colin. You know, she'd been in that mental hospital. That's when I first came to Foxby, right? Well, just after our funeral, Pauline and I went back there to see what the treatment was all about. We never really did know what caused all her mental problems. We found a lot about her, but, you know, some things are still not clear.
Colin rose from the chair. Hold on, let me get another pint, he said. How about you? Wine?
Oh, no thanks, I think two's my limit.
He came back with a beer and set it on the table. He rubbed his forehead, closed his eyes, sighed heavily as he sat down opposite me.
Are you all right? I asked. You do look tired.
You know, I'm here for a few days. We can see each other tomorrow.
Oh, no. I get headaches, that's all. I'm okay. If you think you're going to get away from me now, you're mistaken.
He smiled and his eyes softened as he studied my face. I said, Colin, don't look at me that lad. When you last saw me, I was 19. I'm 70 now.
Hey, lass, I only see the girl I loved very much. She hasn't changed.
His words made me start the waterworks again. He handed me his handkerchief. It was clean and white. I sniffed.
You still use real handkerchiefs?
Of course, he said, and I ironed them. We both laughed, which seemed to end the tension between us.
So, he said, what about your mum?
Well, you know, she was a bit strange. I said, you know, she talked to dead people, but she often complained that she heard a bell in her head. When she was worried or stressed, she said she still heard noises. Noises, horses running down the street after her. She was terrified.
Oh, could have been schizophrenia, Colin said.
No, doctors didn't diagnose that. In fact, I read a report from one of her hypnosis sessions. It was all there in black and white. Questions from the doctor, answers from Mum.
Under hypnosis, she said in her past life, she was a child living in the city, and there was a curfew bell at 9 o'clock at night. Then there were the horses pulling drays. They were running after her in the street. She was terrified. Who knows where that came from? You know, I thought that when she was a little girl, there was a fire station at the end of Grey Street, where she and her mum lived. I thought she must have remembered the street cleaners. Drays with barrels of water. Horses, you know.
I shook my head. I don't know. I don't know what made her ever hear those noises.
Colin took a swig of beer.
You know, he said, it is a fact that in the late 1600s, when chamber pots were emptied into the streets, along with the butchers, detritus and all that, the local farmers came to collect it with their horses. They had barrels, used it for fertilizer. But you see, they were not allowed to pick it up until after 9 at night. There was a curfew bell. It was warning people, residents, they should get on home. If kids were found wandering the streets after 9 at night, they were often kidnapped, taken away to work on the farms.
Is that right? I said.
Oh, yes. Colin leaned his elbows on the table. My mother lived in Leicester City before she married my dad and came out here. She said her mother would call her in the street. If you don't come in now, the 9 o'clock horses will get you. I suspect that was a threat to kids to get there, you know, to come on home. He took a swig of beer. As you know, Leicester's one of the oldest cities in England. I think it was the mid-18th century before they had outhouses. You know, those pit latrines. The chamber pots were emptied out into the streets from the upstairs window. You know, that was medieval times. Yes, I said, and the women would call out, "Gardy Lou," which is where the word loo comes from. And that's why gents always had to walk on the roadside of the sidewalk. That's right, Amelia. Well, you do sound like an American. How so? We don't have sidewalks, we have pavements. Right. Anyway, Colin, why didn't you go back to New York when you came out of Vietnam? You know, New York didn't appeal to me in the slightest. I do like England better. And, he hesitated, I think you should move back too. I smiled, shook my head. I said, well, I think it's time we said good night. Looks as though we're being thrown out. He kissed me gently on the cheek. All right. Night, lass, he said. Let's meet at the bridge tomorrow or come to the house, okay? I watched him walk down the street and round the corner, out of sight. The next day was sunny and bright as I walked through the fields to the bridge, our favourite place to meet, always had been. I could still not quite believe that Colin was alive and well. When I saw him coming from the farm, wearing his tweed jacket with the leather elbow patches, I realised nothing had really changed. We both looked down at the water beneath the bridge. He quoted aloud, "All along the backwater through the rushes tall, ducks are a-dabbling, up tails all." "Oh, Colin," I said, "you don't forget anything, do you?" He hugged me close and I kissed him back, wondering now where all this would lead. When he released me and stood back to look at me, he said, "Would your daughter mind if you move back to England? We are getting on, you know. Might as well make the best of the years we have left together. What do you think?" The question hung in the air. I had all I wanted in America, but then, all at once, I wasn't sure what I wanted. "I would like you to come and live with me, you know that." I said, "Well, I'd love to be with you, but it'd be a big move for me. I mean, my whole adult life has been in America. And my daughter, well, I just don't know about leaving her. I can't imagine being without her." "I understand," he said. "Okay." He grabbed my hand. "Shall we get an ice cream in the village?" I laughed. "You always brought me an ice cream when I was little." "Aye," he said. "By the way, I was thinking of getting some travelling done while I'm still able to get around a bit. I just received a brochure about a tour of New Zealand and Australia. I'll show it to you. The fares are not bad and I think you might like it." "Well, Colin, you've got my number, knowing how much I love to travel." "Aye," he said. "Sounds like you've done a lot, but not to that part of the world, right?" "Right," I said. The whole day flew by. We were just talking. Later, Colin cooked a delicious meal, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. We talked and talked until it grew dusk. Colin turned on some lamps around the room. "Well," I said, "you know, I better get to the inn now. It's been a lovely day." "Hey, lass, why don't you stay the night with me?" "No, not tonight. Sorry." "Does that mean you don't want to be with me anymore?" "No, Colin, that's not it. I just don't know." "Okay, okay, lass," he sighed. "I'll walk you back to the pub."
As we walked quietly along the path to the village, Colin said, I love this time of night. Yes, I do, I said. Everything is so still. Colin was speaking softly. The curfew tolls the knoll of parting day. The lowing herd winds slowly o'er the lea. The ploughman homeward plods his weary way and leaves the world to darkness and to me. Now fading the glimmerous landscape on the sight, and all the air a solemn stillness holds. Wow, I said, that's Gray's Elegy. I love that. Yes. I turned back to look at the farmhouse. In the half-light, the field of cowslips glowed like sunshine. You have been listening to the final episode of 9 o'clock Horses, written and read by me, Angela Ewing. You can listen to all the episodes of 9 o'clock Horses on our website, podcasts, on kciw.org, under programs, Storytime. This is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio, on 100.7 FM. Thank you for listening.